Okay, so thanks everyone for being here. This is an awkward time of the quarter. I really appreciate you making it to be here. This has been already my title. It's a bit of a mouthful, but hopefully it becomes clear as I talk what I'm trying to get at with this. A brief outline of what I'm going to be covering. Some of this I spoke about in the last presentation I gave, so I'm going to whiz through some of that stuff just to recap it. Then I'm going to speak briefly about non-racialism and racialism in South Africa historically and post-apartheid. I'll talk a bit about the method and the data that I've been using to address these questions. I'll do a bit of a very brief review on some research on categories, common sense, knowledge, and action, which is relevant for the analysis I'm going to present. And then the analysis itself, the two sections, racial category membership as a resource for action and as a constraint on action. And then I'll talk about some of the implications and conclusions based on that. Okay, so non-racialism, I think most people will be familiar with the concept. It was popularized during the anti-apartheid struggle. It's been a founding value of the New South Africa. It's mentioned in the Constitution. It's in the Freedom Charter. It was a very popular concept for a lot of anti-apartheid activists, particularly within the ANC. And it remains popular in political rhetoric post-apartheid. At the same time, it's often been criticized as a concept for being lacking in content, ambiguous, contradictory. It hasn't been clearly defined or distinguished from non-racism or multiracialism or a number of other kind of similar concepts. So there's been a lot of discussion about what non-racialism actually is, and no clear answers really. And that during the anti-apartheid struggle resulted in a lack of clarity, a lot of confusion, inconsistency with respect to the meanings and the implications of what non-racialism would look like in a democratic South Africa. Then, on the other hand, we have racialism. Obviously, that was associated with the apartheid government. And the hundreds of laws that they passed to make race a primary basis for organizing society. But it was also associated with some of the struggle movements, including the Black Consciousness Movement, the PAC, and some others. And these movements essentially aimed to use racialism, use racial solidarities, turn their back on the apartheid government, and use them as a way of combating race-based oppression. There was this emphasis on racial solidarities and resisting racism. For example, Steve Biko argued that oppressed people of different races should recognize the common basis of their oppression on racial grounds, and popularized the use of the term black to refer to all people of color. As a way of kind of unifying them against apartheid. So that was a sort of racialist, race-based form of resistance. Biko was also opposed to what he called artificial racial integration in the absence of real equality. So he said black and white people need to first overcome their respective superiority and inferiority complexes before they could live in an integrated society as equals. And if integration happened before that had been done, then it would be artificial and it wouldn't be a real true integration with true equality. So obviously these differing approaches to the struggle resulted in tensions and debates between advocates of non-racialism and racialism or race-based resistance. And these features, these tensions have carried over into the post-apartheid era. So we still have the prevalence of these tensions between race consciousness and non-racialism. We still have continuing lack of clarity and ambiguity of the meanings of non-racialism. We still have debates about what it means. We still have people like me getting invited to sit here and talk about what racialism is versus non-racialism. So it's obviously still a significant issue. There's also tensions between non-racism and racism within the ANC government. So a lot of the Black Consciousness Movement ended up being absorbed into the ANC after Steve Biko's death and following the Soweto uprisings. And this resulted in some ideological tensions that remain apparent within the governing party. And then, of course, there's the apparent inconsistencies between the avowed non-racialism of the ANC and the use of race-conscious policies and their redress, so things like affirmative action and Black economic empowerment have resulted in debates about whether these policies should be used, whether they are necessary means for addressing inequalities, or whether they simply serve to reproduce the apartheid-era racial categories. And then in addition to that, these tensions are and dilemmas are apparent in social scientific discourse, where there's a very real concern about how to continue robust lines of inquiry without needlessly reproducing apartheid categories. So here's a quote from one of Jerry's papers that really sums up these concerns. He asks, how do we address the rejection of the actual existence of races as well as the overwhelming existence of the social constructs in having shaped and still shaping the life chances of citizens? How do we avoid our own intellectual curiosity and critical training being blunted through the acceptance, for whatever reason, of these categories of race? So these are issues that social scientists have grappled with in just the same way that policymakers and political parties have debated them. My approach to these questions, rather than tackling them head on and trying to come up with my own answer, my approach is to think of these things as members' problems, meaning problems that ordinary members of society are also dealing with on a day-to-day basis. So my approach is grounded in the ethno-methodological theoretical approach developed by Garfinkel and others. And a central feature of this approach is shifting focus from offering solutions to social problems, like problems of racialism and non-racialism, and shifting instead to investigating how ordinary members of society themselves deal with these problems and what kind of solutions they might have been able to come up with. So, as I say, that means re-specifying these problems as members' problems. And accordingly, the analytic focus is on how ordinary people deal with these problems, looking at what ordinary people do in their everyday lives and what methods they use for managing issues like this. And that's where ethno-methodology comes from. It's ethno-methods, people's methods for dealing with everyday problems. So there's a focus on common sense ways of managing everyday problems. The situated accomplishment of social order, so many things happen in interactions, in local situations, and how social order is produced through the aggregate of all these local interactions. And then looking at people's practices for making sense of and managing everyday contingencies of action, in my case, with respect to race. So how people deal with race in their everyday lives, how they manage the problems posed by race. So I hope you won't be too disappointed to learn that I don't have a magical solution to problems of racialism and non-racialism. But at the same time, I hope after my analysis it will be apparent that my findings do offer some insights into the ways that everyday people in South Africa deal with these problems, and that these insights might be relevant for addressing matters of racialism and non-racialism on other levels. Okay, so the specific analytic approach that I'm using is conversation analysis, which grew developed concurrently with ethno-methodology and converges with it in many ways. So it's sort of the empirical branch, one empirical branch of the ethno-methodology tradition. Here, the assumption of conversation analysis is that interaction is the primary fundamental embodiment of sociality, and we can see that in a way that interaction is a central feature of virtually all institutions of society. So you can think of virtually anything, any aspect of society that gets produced and its problems get dealt with in interaction. So the focus of this approach is then to look at audio and video recorded interactions in either ordinary conversational settings or various institutional settings, and to look at how sociality is produced through these interactions and how people deal with problems in these interactions. Some advantages, quickly, I've mentioned these in my last presentation, but looking at interactional data allows us to study social order as points of production, so looking at where social order actually happens in interactions. It allows us to ground our claims in the orientations of participants, so we can see through what they do in any next turn and talk what they figure has happened before. We can see their analysis of what's going on, and that allows us to use that as evidence for our analysis of what's going on. Also, it allows repeated viewing and listening, so if we have video or audio recordings, we can go through them over and over again and try and notice things that might not be noticeable at first playing, but actually may turn out to be very consequential. And then finally, there's the independent readers or viewers or listeners check on claims. So all the things that I'm going to be claiming, I'm giving you transcripts, I'm playing the recordings of my data, and if you disagree with me, you can raise your disagreements. So we're all using the same basis for developing our analysis of what's going on. Finally, just quickly, the data corpus that I'm basing my analysis on. It consists of 115 hours of audio recorded radio broadcasts. This, in some ways, was a convenient source of data. It's streaming online, it's easy to record using software. So it wasn't out of any particular interest in radio or media that I chose it, but of course it is an institutional setting. So in that respect, it's not, and in other respects, it's not intended to be random or representative. I'm not claiming that it applies to every single setting and every kind of interaction in South Africa, but it does capture a wide range of speakers, and it does capture conversations, interactions that appear, based on my experience, to happen in a lot of other places too. And obviously that's something that will be taken up in the future to try and show that this generalizes beyond this particular context. And then my analysis was based on recordings, as I mentioned, and aided by transcripts, which I'm going to hand out some of in a minute. Firstly, just reviewing some of the previous research that's relevant to what I'll be talking about. So this is research that's been done mostly within conversation analysis, examining the properties of social categories, how they relate to common sense knowledge and social actions, particularly actions and interaction. So I'm going to go quite quickly through these things and just mention them, and hopefully it will be apparent in my analysis why I mentioned them, that they become relevant to what I'm doing. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time discussing them, but just to quickly run through them. The first thing is that categories serve as repositories for, and they organize, common sense cultural knowledge. So categories are associated with common sense knowledge about members of the categories. Just mentioning a category, knowing a person is a member of the category, mobilizes this common sense knowledge. And it's important to note that this knowledge is not necessarily scientifically accurate, and often it's demonstrably inaccurate, but it's treated by members of society as if it is essentially accurate. So it has the status of working knowledge, or knowledge that people assume is true until they are shown otherwise, and they go through their everyday lives kind of assuming that it is true. Second thing is that categories are inference rich, so that means anything that is known about a category is assumed to be known, assumed to be so, about any person who is established to be a member of that category. So the knowledge about any given category is assumed to apply to any member of that category. The third thing then is that categories are associated with typical activities and conduct, which Harvey Sachs called category-bound activities. And these are things like, for example, an activity crying is bound to the category baby. So we expect babies to cry because it's the kind of activity that babies engage in. And of course, that doesn't mean that people who aren't babies can't also cry. But if they do, they can become vulnerable to being told, stop crying, you're not a baby. So in that way, pedigrees and the knowledge and activities associated with them can be used to kind of discipline people to behave according to the way they should be behaving. So that kind of goes along with the association between categories and rights, various rights, obligations, authority, entitlements, and so on. So being a member of a category can make one an expert on the experiences relevant to that category. It can confer various rights and responsibilities associated with membership. For example, family members have the right and maybe even the responsibility to help fellow family members in need. Friends have the rights to say and do things that people who aren't friends maybe wouldn't get away with, and so on. So there's various things that are associated, rights, authorities, responsibilities, entitlements, and so on, associated with being members of a particular category. Categories can be constitutive features or methods for accomplishing and recognizing action. So what that means is that sometimes knowing what category a person is a member of is necessary in order to know what they're doing. So for example, if we see a policewoman standing in the middle of a busy intersection and we identify her as a policewoman, and she's waving her arms around, then we can understand that what she's doing is directing traffic. On the other hand, if we see a person who looks like a civilian standing in the middle of an intersection doing that same activity, we're going to think they're calling for help or they have a death wish or something like that. So knowing what category a person is a member of can actually help us figure out what they're doing when we're trying to figure out what they're doing. Mentioning a category, just identifying someone as a member of a category mobilizes all this knowledge about rights and authority, the links between categories and action, and knowledge, and so on. Mentions of social categories are ways in which all of these things get mobilized in interactions. Okay, so I've chosen a very few pieces of data to look at. I have a handout with some transcripts on them that I'm going to pass around. I want to just say I'd like to leave some time at the end for discussion. I'm not going to do complete analysis. I'm not going to say anything and everything that could be said about each of these cases. I'm going to point out the most important things. I am working on a paper that's going to be available through the center hopefully soon. That'll have more details if you're interested in reading more about this. And we can discuss, obviously, in the question and answer period further things. Okay, so the first set of things that I'm interested in or that I'm going to talk about is how racial category membership, as a result of all these features of categories that I've described, can serve as a resource for action, for accomplishing action. So the first two excerpts are going to relate to that. First I'll just give a bit of background to the first one, and then I'll play it, and then I'll point out the particular things that that I think are important. Okay, so the first excerpt, a person is called into the show, and is talking about a ruling by the Human Rights Commission, which found that the Federation of Black Journalists, the FBJ, had acted unconstitutionally in preventing white journalists from attending one of their gatherings. So the court is calling in to discuss this ruling by the Human Rights Commission. And he asks a question about what implications this ruling has or might have for the constitutionality of affirmative action. Now, this is potentially an ambiguous question. It could be a question. He could be concerned about what the implications of this are for affirmative action. So he could be coming from a position of supporting affirmative action, not wanting it to be ruled unconstitutional, or it could be a complaint about affirmative action. So it could be, by asking this question, he's pointing out an inconsistency there and suggesting that affirmative action needs to be done away with. So a question like this is terrible in two different ways. It's kind of ambiguous in that way. The thing to notice here in this excerpt is the way that the speaker can use his racial identity to contribute to what he's doing in Hannibal as just a question rather than a complaint. So that's the thing to listen out for. And you can follow on the transcript or just listen or both.
The ruling by the Human Rights Commission in terms of the whole FPJ thing. I just want you maybe to clarify something for me.
Yeah, what's that?
Affirmative action has in my understanding white people cannot get certain jobs because simply they are white. If I am a white person going to an interview and we are both qualified, I'm going to be the first person to get that job.
Yes, to kind of like this approach.
Yeah, you know, the fact is I'm black, I should get that job. Now, I want to find out, you know, in terms of the ruling, what are the incomes do you think? Do you see every idea or me? Am I misunderstanding?
I think, you know, it's a very subtle point, yeah, from what I understand. You cannot say for this job only blacks must apply. Now you are being racist. But you can say this job is open to everybody. But if two people, one previously advantaged, as they call it, one previously disadvantaged and three disadvantaged, and I have to choose between the two, know that I'll take the other one. So the basis is different. For instance, they are saying,
okay, so the important things I kind of flagged what I thought was important in advance, but the details of this are as follows. In the course of asking his question, the caller shows that he identifies as a black person. So he places himself as a hypothetical job applicant in the scenario, in contrast with a hypothetical white person. And he actually, in lines 17 and 18, says, the fact is, I'm black, I should get that job. So he shows that he identifies as a black person, and he constructs his question in such a way that he reveals that about himself. Second thing to notice is that the host responds to his question as a question, rather than as a complaint. So he takes it as at face value. He responds to it as reflecting a concern on behalf of the caller, and he explains the distinction between this ruling and the question of constitutionality of affirmative action. And then the third thing is that the caller accepts this response by saying okay on line 34, so he shows that the host has given the kind of answer he was looking for. So we can see then that the caller, the host treats the caller's question as a question rather than a complaint. The caller accepts this treatment of his question, so shows that he's aligned with the assumption that what he was doing is just asking a question. Now, if we imagine if he constructed the same scenario but identified himself as the white applicant who didn't get the job rather than the black applicant who did get the job, we might hear this question in a rather different way. So in the case where he identifies himself as a white person, asking the same kind of question, he might be understood as complaining about opportunities that have been denied to him as a result of a policy that now appears to be possibly unconstitutional. So it would be, in that case, terrible as a complaint, partly because of the status as a person who would be overlooked for jobs as a result of affirmative action. So by showing that he's black rather than white, the caller's racial identity contributes to what he's doing being heard as one thing rather than another, a question rather than a complaint. And it's important that this understanding relies on unspoken common sense knowledge about South Africa's racialized past and present. So making sense of this knowledge is necessary for making sense of what the caller is doing here. So to make sense of what he's doing, we have to know that people of the category he is identifying as are potential beneficiaries of affirmative action. We have to know that affirmative action is designed to redress past inequalities and that black people are defined as previously disadvantaged and as targeted for redress by policies like this. So by drawing on this kind of, by mentioning his category, he's drawing on this common sense knowledge about the category, it's contributing to the action that he's doing, and it's kind of renewing these connections between racialized past and racialized present, past inequalities and present policies designed to redress those inequalities. And all of this is kind of done without being mentioned in so many words. No one says anything about, although the host does mention previously disadvantaged, it's kind of taken for granted why these people were previously disadvantaged. It's taken for granted that they are still disadvantaged. A lot of things are kind of beneath the surface and never have to be mentioned because they're common sense knowledge. So this is the kind of common sense knowledge that I'm talking about. Okay, so moving on to excerpt two. Another case where racial category membership serves as a resource for action. So just in case I didn't make it clear enough, the reason I'm saying that racial category membership in this first case is a resource for action is because it's a resource for producing an action that's understandable as the thing that was intended to be. So it's a resource for doing something in a recognizable, intelligible way. Okay, so a second case, excerpt two, where racial category membership serves as a resource for action in a slightly different way. Here is a case where Archbishop Desmond Tutu is a guest on the show, and a caller calls in to praise him for his work and for all the things he's done. And here, the racial self-identification of the caller serves as a way of emphasizing the significance of what he's doing and praising Tutu. So listen out here for how difficult the caller is finding it to get any kind of response out of Tutu, and how identifying himself racially is something that he does in pursuit of a response.
Bishop, really, this is too cute, really, sir. But it's an honor, sir, it's an honor. Anyway, I just want to say that the fact that you think your humor with your religion is actually makes you a unique person, really, that means so much to so many of us. It really, really does. And you'll never know how much you've meant to us. My wife, South Africa, and really, sir.
Thank
you very much.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry, Richard. Thank you so much. There's another call. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Okay, quite thankful to listen to. Imagine listening to it 100 times while you're talking about it. Okay, so I think we can all see here how difficult the caller is finding it to get any kind of response out of the Archbishop. He's pursued it in numerous places, so good to talk to you. Tutu could respond there, but he doesn't. Really, sir, could respond there, but he doesn't. And there's a pause where he doesn't respond. And he actually, in fact, there does say, God bless you, but the caller by that time is starting up again. It's an honor. Could respond there. It's an honor, sir. Could respond there. It's an honor. So three more places where he could have responded. No response. A long pause. Uncomfortable pause, still no response, and I won't point out all the other places, but there's a lot of places where he's getting no response. And after all these attempts, or a number of these attempts, eventually he racially identifies himself by specifying what he means by us. So he said, this means so much to so many of us, in line 12, and then he says, you'll never know how much you've meant to us, and then he goes on and says, I'm talking about white South Africa. So having tried to get a response a few times, he's praised the Archbishop. He said, you meant so much to so many of us. Yeah, the host responds, but not the not Tutu. And eventually the caller says, I'm talking about white South Africa, and he's laughing as he says it. So when he does that, he designs it as a way of emphasizing the significance of his praise. He's effectively saying that Tutu and his work have been so important that he even has meant a lot to white South Africans, not just black South Africans. So in this way, the caller treats his racial identity as a basis for a kind of heightened authority, or adding extra weight or legitimacy to his praise, because he's praising the Archbishop as a person who has would ordinarily be understood as not having been a primary beneficiary of his work. So again, we have this common sense knowledge here. We have to figure out how it is that this racial identification is doing something, is heightening his praise, is pursuing response from him. We have to see that the caller is implicitly suggesting here that his praise is noteworthy by virtue of coming from a person of a category who normally wouldn't be considered a primary beneficiary of Tutu's work. And this in turn rests on knowing which categories of people would be primary beneficiaries. That of course requires knowing something about South Africa's racial history, knowing something about Tutu's role in anti-apartheid struggles and so on. So again, we have this common sense knowledge being renewed, knowledge of the past being linked to knowledge of the present, renewed and called up by the caller's use of his racial identity as a resource for doing something simple like praising and trying to get a response to his praise. Okay, moving on to racial category membership as a constraint on action, which is the converse of it being a resource. The next two excerpts show examples of how it, some ways it can be a constraint. So firstly, we have excerpt 3, where a caller is complaining about government denial, as he puts it, with regard to violent crime. And in doing this, he treats his racial identity as applying diminished rights, in this case, diminished rights authority, to make a complaint like this. So we're listening for the way that he orients to his identity as implying diminished rights in this way.
I don't want to sound like I'm beating a drum here, but the government's denial, jeez, I tell you that, it sickens me to my stomach. Last week we had a minister saying, South Africans are not like this. I mean, we're living in one of the most violent countries in the world. Now, I'm not saying all South Africans are like this.
No, most of us are.
That we have a terribly violent society, and yet, the white folks blame for that, the apartheid system.